Hello and welcome behind the news. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And two interviews lined up for tonight. First, in a little while, we'll be speaking with a little bit of a departure for this program, a fiction writer, Caitlin Macy, who is the author of a collection of stories called Spoiled, which is recently published by Random House. We can talk to her about the jealousies of class in America, and well, forbidden topic, at least in a lot of mainstream discourse. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with the economist Teresa Ghilarducci, who teaches at the New School in New York and is a specialist in pensions. And we'll talk to her about what's up with Social Security, what we're likely to see in terms of Social Security reform from the Obama administration, and her own ideas of how to rework the retirement system. Before all that, some words of the economic news. And the latest bits of economic news are actually a little better than the recent run has been. First-time claims for unemployment insurance filed by people who just lost their jobs fell by 12,000 last week. The four-week moving average, which smoothed out this volatile series, rose slightly to make a new high for this recession. But it's possible that the rate of deterioration is now slowing. In other words, the job market is terrible, but at least it's not getting rapidly worse, at least over the last few weeks. The big surprise of the week, however, was a rise in housing starts. Most of the rise came in multifamily dwellings. The rise in single-family starts, which are probably more economically meaningful, was just a few thousand. More promising, applications for permits to build new houses also rose, with permits to build single-family units leading the way up. As I've been pointing out here for the last few months, permits tend to lead the way on housing, and housing tends to lead the way on the broad economy. So this is a sign that things might be turning, or if not turning, at least stabilizing, for now. But the Conference Board's leading economic indicator, which is which leads developments in the broad economy by 3 to 6 months, fell in February, led down by falls in consumer attitudes and in the stock market. The decline was fairly modest, however, less than half the rate we saw last October and November. Chalk this up as another possible sign of stabilization. Possible. For now. I've been expecting that the economy would take a sharp fall and then stabilize at a crappy level for quite a while. There's a chance that we're in that transitional phase from free fall to the routinization of crappy. This crisis has surprised us by coming back for repeated visits, so the last thing to do right now would be to sound the all clear. Here's an insight into the capitalist mind provided by the Financial Times columnist Stefan Wagstall. In a review of the state of Eastern European economies, a state that is pretty terrible, Wagstall points to several advantages those economies have over their Western counterparts. Employers in the East have been quick to cut wages and fire workers, much quicker than those in the West. This is what's known as flexibility. And family ties are closer in the East than in the West, meaning the unemployed have something to fall back on. Isn't that comforting? You can get fired so quick you wouldn't know what happened to you and have your pay cut by a third, but at least you can crash in your uncle's couch. The economic crisis is looking like bad news for the environment. As the 1980s boom turned into the early 90s bust, I recall that The Economist, the magazine that mysteriously calls itself a newspaper, editorialized that green consciousness always rises late in economic expansion as a kind of byproduct of guilt over material indulgence and then dissipates in the subsequent contraction as attention turns instead to survival. I was skeptical of the thesis, but there may be something to it. Thursday morning, Gallup reported that for the first time in the 25 years they've been asking the question, more Americans want to give economic growth priority over protecting the environment. The exact question is, with which one of these statements about the environment and the economy do you most agree? Protection of the environment should be given priority, even at the risk of curbing economic growth, or economic growth should be given priority, even if the environment suffers to some extent? That's the end of the question. To guard against stacking the answers, the order of those two statements is reversed for half the respondents. Given a choice between two options, people tend to favor the first offered, and the scrupulous pollster tries to compensate for that by shifting order around. From 1985, when they first asked the question, through 2000, the environment was given priority by a wide margin, typically 30 to 50 percentage points. The environment's advantage began narrowing with the recession of 2001 and the subsequent weak recovery, with the environment's advantage almost disappearing in 2003. But as the expansion continued, the environment's lead widened to 18 points in 2007. But that gap then followed the economy down. Now economic growth has the advantage over the environment by 9 points. That's a massive swing, about 60 percentage points from the environment's widest lead to its current lag. Just a week ago, Gallup reported a record high of 41% of Americans expressing the belief that fears of global warming are exaggerated. Since the economy is likely to stink for some time, this is extremely bad news for anyone who cares about transforming human relationship with our natural environment. And wow, what about those AIG bonuses? Normally, I'd consider this a peripheral issue, since the sums involved are just 1/10 of 1% of the total that the company has gotten in bailout funds, a symbolic distraction from the real issues. I'm not going to say that this time, because this symbol represents and crystallizes a couple of deeply real things. One, the chutzpah of Wall Street, which still wants to take all the money it can without any other consideration. And two, the weakness and or complicity of the Obama administration, which refuses to step on toes and twist arms. Their strategy continues Bush's, write big checks, but make no demands. That's a stark contrast with the Swedish strategy during their bank bailout of the early 1990s, a precedent that I've mentioned often here. An article on Sweden's bailout in Wednesday's Financial Times quoted the finance ministry official then in charge of the bank restructuring as saying, quote, "We were a no-BS investor." He used the full, unbroadcastable term, a no-BS investor. "We were very brutal. You take command. If you put in equity, you have to get into the management of the business. Otherwise, management is focused on saving the skins of the shareholders." That's the end of the quote from the Swedish finance ministry fellow. The Obama administration is clearly a pro-BS investor, refusing to take any kind of command. We now learn that the worthless Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, pressed Senator Chris Dodd to insert language into the stimulus legislation, which otherwise purported to be cracking down on Wall Street compensation, that specifically protected the AIG payments. You have to wonder how hard Dodd had to be pressed on this. Over the years, he's gotten almost $300,000 in campaign contributions from AIG executives. Despite the protestations to the contrary, it's clear that the administration could have blocked the payments. A friend who works on Wall Street told me that it's hardly unknown for firms to renege on bonus payments. They can just refuse to pay and wait for the employees to sue, but employees often don't sue because it would cost a lot of money and trouble for an individual to go up against a huge corporation, or in the case of AIG, against the U.S. government, which owns AIG. Or they could have just fired the employees for cause and never had to pay the bonuses. And the cause would include, like, really doing a bad job, which they certainly did. Failing that, you can almost always find something to fire people for. All you can have to do is read their email. There's almost always something that's a firing offense lurking there. The federal government owns 80% of AIG. It owns big chunks of Wall Street names. But the government refuses to start acting like owners. Speaking of AIG, the Wall Street Journal reported on Wednesday that some of AIG's bailout money is likely to go to hedge funds who speculated on a rise in mortgage defaults. The details are complex, but it boils down to this. AIG sold insurance to investors in subprime mortgages that would pay off in case the underlying mortgages went into foreclosure. They did go into foreclosure, but AIG didn't have the money to pay off on their promises. So the government is stepping up to the plate. Isn't that lovely? Washington is supposedly trying to prevent foreclosures, and here it is, making good on speculative positions that are profitable solely because foreclosures are on the rise. The contradictions. And the latest news from the Department of Wretched Excess. Citigroup is planning to spend $10 million in a new set of offices for its CEO, Vikram Pandit, and his lieutenants. Citi says this is all part of a cost-cutting strategy, which under different circumstances might be totally hilarious. I swear it looks like these guys are trying to provoke a class war. Well, there has been a class war from above going on for the last 30 years, but I mean a real class war from below, one that might even disturb the sleep of the privileged. Maybe I'm being too romantic. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the privileged.
Arise, ye workers, from your slumbers. Arise, ye prisoners of want. For reason and revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of cant. Away with all your superstition, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition, we'll spurn the dust to win the prize. So comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale. unites the human race.
And that's some of the Internationale performed by the Scottish singer Alistair Hewlett. I love that sneer. It's a superstition. It's wonderful. Nice soundtrack for thinking about class, I guess. We're now joined in the studio by Caitlin Macy, who is author of a collection of stories called Spoiled, just published by Random House. Well received, just like her novel, The Foundations of Play, or Fundamentals of Play. Sorry about that. Welcome to Behind the News, Caitlin.
Thanks, Doug.
So, class is one of these things that Americans feel rather uncomfortable talking about, and you've made it your topic. How'd you decide to plunge into this difficult terrain?
It's funny, I've always been interested in, you know, I've always read novels about class, and sort of those were always my favorite books for some reason. I think, you know, going back to Austin and, you know, sort of continuing straight on through, but it probably has something to do with my sort of topsy-turvy background of, you know, having gone to boarding school but gone on financial aid, and so sort of having my antenna really raised to the sort of social markers, if you will, of the different, you know, rungs, I guess you could say. And I've just always been fascinated by it, and sort of probably to a fault in that I won't stick with a novel that, you know, isn't about class.
Well, you also, from what I read about you, there was some money in the family once, and it got dwindled away, right?
Absolutely. My dad grew up, well, in his boyhood at least, very well off. He's sort of World War II generation, born in the 20s. And, you know, we sort of heard stories growing up about the 40-room house and the servants and all the, you know, sort of fun they'd have sneaking the car out while the chauffeur's back was turned. And my circumstances, needless to say, were very different. So that probably got me started on the issue pretty early.
And he joined the Air Force?
He did. I mean, it was sort of a time when college educations weren't sort of as prevalent, you know, as they are now. And his father at that point, when my dad was 18, was actually close to bankruptcy. So he kind of wanted to get rid of him, and he marched him downtown and enlisted him. It was at that point the Air Force was still part of the Army, but he went off to Iceland at the age of 18. So
this was during World War II or after that?
Let's see, would have been I think just before. Let's see, my dad was born in 22, so oh no, that's right. He was in Iceland during the war. Yeah.
A country now, of course, that's
yeah, it's funny.
Very different what it was then. But now these stories are set mostly in the New York of recent history, but it was before the bust and it all came crashing down. What would things look like now if you're writing these stories? Are these people on the ropes?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I always think it's kind of self-indulgent to sort of extrapolate your characters' lives after the story because it almost gives them too much credit. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot's been made of the book sort of being in this Upper East Side rarefied echelon, when in fact, you know, a few of the characters that I can think of are kind of sort of barely clinging to their, you know, one-bedroom apartment sort of on the far, far east side of the Upper East Side. So let's say the sort of, like, you know, barely surviving members of the Upper East Side, I think the crash would have hit them very hard. And yeah, I think you know, I mean, hubby would have lost his job and they'd probably be moving to the burbs and putting their kids in public school. You know, horror of horrors.
Several of the women that you write about are stay-at-home moms. They're not pursuing their own hard-charging career themselves. Is that kind of typical of the set you're thinking of?
Well, you know, I mean, it's pretty easy to, you know, to give the milieu that rap, and obviously, you know, plenty of the women work, and I definitely consider myself sort of agnostic in, like, the sort of, you know, mommy wars and you know, who works and who doesn't work. I mean, obviously plenty of women on the Upper East Side work, but having said that, it's also, it's not really surprising, you know, it's not a really controversial statement to say that, you know, plenty of socialites also live on the Upper East Side. So I think, you know, yeah, there have been a few articles written lately. You know, there are a lot of women who, certainly a number of my friends who have, you know, quite elite educations who, for different reasons, opted out of the workforce when they could.
Yeah, well, I guess Louise Story of the Times got a lot of attention for that piece she did about all the recent Yalies who had worked for a few years and then withdrew. And then
I think it became
actually a big controversy in labor economics whether this is actually really happening or not.
Right. Was it a cooked up story? And I think she even interviewed the sort of more shocking thing where the current undergrads that weren't even planning to work, they were. I think one woman said she was going to get her law degree and then have children and quit. Am I right?
Yeah.
Is that the one?
Yeah, it's an option foreclosed to most people.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of drama too about relating to the servant class and the nanny class. Is the degree of discomfort some kind of function of whether one is relatively new to the world or well established in the upper class?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that part of the reason there's been so much angst, and I'm thinking of all the Caitlin Flanagan articles and so forth about one's relationship with one's nanny and so forth in the press, is that, you know, most of us, say born in the 60s and 70s, who then had access to these elite educations, did not grow up with servants in the house. I mean, that used to be the province of the very rich, the sort of like funny, ha-ha, you know, Baxter, Batcher, Hatcher, Thurston Wilder. I mean, that kind of, you know, old way of thinking about wealth, of inherited money. And suddenly, you know, found ourselves in these knowledge economy cities with good educations and full-time jobs. And, you know, lo and behold, have a cleaning woman. And then if, you know, certainly if you keep your job after you have children, a lot of women, a lot of my peers have nannies. And I think there's, for people with, you know, a conscience and a sort of sense of vertigo, when they look at their own lives compared to, say, their parents' lives and how they were raised, there's a lot of angst with dealing with household employees. I mean, we're not talking about the, you know, English aristocrats who, you know, had you know, grew up with, as my dad did, you know, with fleets of servants and so forth, and for whom it comes really naturally. I think it is something that's just very anxiety-making if you're not used to it, if you didn't grow up that way.
Yeah, I had a guest on the show a couple of years ago, a sociologist who studied luxury hotels, and she said that one of the tasks that the staff was learning at this or had to practice at the hotel was making guests feel comfortable who might not have been used to that level of service. They had to sort of cosset them into thinking that you deserve this, but doing it very subtly without drawing attention to it. It seemed like a very difficult skill to master.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. But, you know, the rise of the Danny Meyer restaurant phenomenon in New York, where, you know, people don't want the scary French sommelier sort of advising them. They want, you know, friendly service, and they want to be made to feel comfortable.
I was speaking with Caitlin Macy, the author of a collection of stories called Spoiled, that just came out from Random House. You bring out a point that these kinds of class and wealth distinctions have certainly gotten greatly exaggerated over the last 20 or 30 years from what they used to be. I went to Yale in the early 70s, and everybody tried to be just folks. You know, there was not the distinctions. I mean, you could certainly tell. And, you know, I grew up in a modest suburb in New Jersey. I was upwardly mobile going there. I was, you know, not coming at it from the other direction. And I was certainly aware of all these class distinctions, but they were not anywhere near as frank as they seemed to get some years later. I mean, you were there in, what, the early 90s? Was it really visible?
You know, that's funny, because I wouldn't have necessarily said that. I mean, I think of, you know, Calvin Trillin's book, Remembering Denny, where he talks about when he was there, obviously a generation before you, but where, you know, you sort of had the white shoe and the brown shoe and the sort of, I think, black shoe kids. I thought that was sort of the opposite, where when I went, it was all sort of, oh, it's this, you know, compared to the 70s, I'm sure it was quite different. But, you know, there was a kind of presumed equality that sort of maybe masked the fact that, you know, some kids were working in the dining hall and some kids were going to St. Moritz, you know. So that's right, but I can't imagine it must not have been anything like it was in the 70s. But I guess compared to the 50s, say, it was probably – there was probably this sort of more blanket of egalitarianism when I was there, which maybe masked the struggles that some people had to go there.
Well, yeah, it's true. The elite does present somewhat differently now, and they don't dress as fancily as the elite of 50 years ago. It's just like everybody is just, well, there's that hedge fund casual style of dress that is very expensive, but pretends not to be.
Well, right, and I mean Silicon Valley, right? They started it. They started. They ditched the ties, and they, you know.
Yeah.
The sort of like guy in the khakis with the running shoes. I mean, that phenomenon's not more than 15, 20 years old.
Yeah.
Well, 10 years, maybe.
Bill Gates being the poster boy for that.
Right.
Guy's worth $50 billion and he dresses like a nerd in the school cafeteria. But there's a lot of the characters that you write about have this. They don't seem very comfortable with themselves. They're constantly evaluating themselves, their friends, their former friends. Is there any pleasure in this this striving after the status of joining the inner circle?
That's a good question. I mean, obviously I was, you know, writing these stories. There wasn't much of a book in sort of writing about people who were striving, made some money, and now were moderately content in their lives. So I was focusing on the neurotic and the people who are really uncomfortable in their skins. I mean, I think, ironically enough, to go back to what we were talking about earlier, for these characters, they don't really have their problems aren't really real problems. And so I think that there's an anxiety associated with, say, nature didn't conspire for 80 million years for people to not have to worry about getting food on the table, for instance. And so all their problems are, to use a sort of buzzword of the hour, you know, they sort of have these derivative problems, like, oh, my cleaning woman isn't being deferential enough to me. So I think that's the crux of it. There's really not much pleasure in being in the kind of striver class, because there's always somebody next door who's, you know, a hell of a lot farther along than you are. James Atlas's piece in The New Yorker years ago about the little rich, I've been using as a shortcut phrase, because I just thought it was a really iconic way to put it. You know, you sort of had these people who maybe got farther than they themselves even expected to, but unfortunately, you know, then you had the internet bubble and the guy next door has, you know, 10 times what you have. And so it's sort of always, you know, a situation where people are always comparing themselves, and there's that fact that everyone's tossing around nowadays where, you know, you're happier having a little bit more than your neighbor rather than having more actual income, I think.
It's all relative.
So it's sort of sad because there just really isn't much pleasure in what they have achieved. They're not sort of sitting back and saying, hey, this is great. I've I can afford to pay someone to do my cleaning, whereas, you know, my mother couldn't. It's instead, you know, constant situation of constant comparison and guilt and angst.
No, but is there anyone who's actually securely arrived, or is everyone worried at this about these sorts of issues?
Well, you mean, are you saying pre-crash, post-crash, or just in general?
Well, that's a good question. Let's say pre-crashed.
I think that people, I mean, I personally think that the people who have arrived are the people who, you know, have enough so that they don't have to worry, which obviously is saying that they have quite a lot, but are able to enjoy it, are able to make the choices that enable them to enjoy it, whether it's, I don't know, moving out of the city so that it goes farther, or just focusing more on things that give them pleasure that aren't necessarily purchased, you know, material goods or you know, what have you. But people who are able to sort of, you know, I guess the mentality I'm thinking of is more sort of a European mentality where, you know, even, a working class guy would still, you know, maybe have a wine cellar because, you know, he takes pleasure in wine. Whereas here, it all just seems sort of punishing when you're focused primarily on the climb.
You spent some time in London. Is it pretty similar there, or was it during, you know, the time you were there?
Well, I mean, when we were there, there was certainly, you know, the hedge fund bubble and so forth, and you saw a lot of the kind of American ways, you know, infiltrating. But no, I mean, I think I would group England much more with Europe in that sense. I would say that, you know, because there's more of an intact class structure and everybody sort of knows that they're never going to be an actual aristocrat with their 5,000 acres and their inherited houses and so forth. So they can kind of get on with it and enjoy themselves more. Whereas here, I think there's always some notion that you could sort of get another rung up if you just worked harder.
Yeah, when I first made my acquaintance with the upper classes at Yale in the early 70s, so that was the tail end of the heyday of the WASP. When, you know, they were riding high and topsiders and those beat up old station wagons and the whole WASP aesthetic was still dominant. But there is this constant battle, or was, between, you know, blood and pedigree versus money. Did money win that battle over the last couple of decades?
Oh, certainly in America. I mean, but I think it's a little bit of a smokescreen to say that in America, pedigree, say, for lack of a better word, had ever really triumphed, because, you know, even Wharton's writing about, you know, the Age of Innocence, she's writing about, you know, the moneyed Arabists coming in and sort of, you know, punching into New York society. And I think, yeah, to sort of a crushing extent nowadays, it's really, you know, has been about money, which again is very different from England, where, you know, they still sort of, you know, value idiosyncrasy, and they, you know, they almost I think they
too much money is vulgar, even.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit of an Anglophile, I should confess, but I do think that they they aren't as impressed with money as we are, simply because, you know, they have this, you know, this inherited class structure.
So are you writing any stories about post-bust, the social set after the bust?
I was thinking that somebody really has to do the, you know, the sort of AIG wife or, you know, something along those lines. It's just begging to be done. But I'm not at the moment.
But what do you see in that? Is it really tearing things apart for the kinds of characters that populated your stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's very much on everyone's mind. I can't really speak to specifics, obviously, but there's certainly like a sort of doom and gloom feeling. I mean, on the other hand, there's a little bit of that, you know, maybe not exactly euphoria, but sort of relief that it's over. I mean, I think people just felt, I can't read one more New York Magazine story about, you know, some hedge fund gazillionaire and his 9,000 square foot house in the Hamptons. And I mean, I think there's a little bit of, you know, Schadenfreude certainly in the air. And I think, you know, people are sort of hoping that it'll change the dialogue, you know, and so it's, to the extent that it won't all be about money. I mean, that it might get, you know, especially, you know, with Obama now, it would be the sort of, we can talk about more interesting things now, you know? I mean, not to say that, you know, oh, yay for the crash, but, you know, it's just that, you know, there's a kind of like maybe smoking out of some of the most egregious excesses.
Well, as Wallace Stevens said, money is a kind of poetry. So
I didn't know that.
All right. Well, I have to say, your writing style is really wonderful. And it just, you capture great insights in a couple of sentences, and it's really very elegantly done. So
thank you.
Everyone should pick up the book, and good luck with it, and I look forward to more.
I've been speaking with
Caitlin Macy, who is the author of Spoiled, a collection of stories about the upper reaches, in and about the upper reaches of this society, just published by Random House. Let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about pensions.
We are Soweto Gospel Choir. And you are listening to BAI New York. BAI New York.
And this is WBAI in New York at 99.5 in your FM dial, and also on the web at WBAI.org. And please do visit that website and click the donate button and help us out in these tough times. We do need it. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk with Teresa Ghilarducci. And that was some of Bach's English Suite No. 2 in A minor, the Gigue, performed by Martha Argerich. And we're now joined in the studio by Teresa Ghilarducci, who teaches at the New School and is an author of much material on pensions. Remember the book Labor's Capital from more than a few years ago now, isn't it?
That's right. That was 92. And then right. I just published When I'm 64. The Plot Against Pensions and the Plan to Save Them.
Ah, well, it is a plot against pensions. I've been obsessed with that myself for a number of years. And you have a title at the Schwartz Center at the New School, right?
The director of the Center for Economic Policy Analysis.
Okay. It used to be just SEPA, and now it's the Schwartz SEPA,
right?
We are, I guess if we ever stop thinking about financial crisis, we will start thinking about reforming the pension system, not that they're unrelated material.
That's right.
What do you see the political system generating?
Well, you know, the economic system might be generating the political realities. Well, last week it looked like with the new economic data on capacity utilization and unemployment that we are in a recession that's much worse, or is beginning to look like it's going to be worse than the 82 recession, which means that the only competitor for this recession is the Great Depression of 1930. And in 1930, there were all sorts of programs, bold programs that were generated, and one of them was the most successful government program in the past 100 years, and that is the Social Security system. So I think this economic crisis actually may generate a new kind of Social Security system. And with the stock market in particular, but also all financial markets, really looking abysmal, having caused people to lose a lot of wealth, permanent wealth, probably wealth they'll never recover, this might be the best time to actually think about those bold reforms of the pension system. And I have some ideas.
Yeah, well, we have now the president and his top economic advisor, Larry Summers, both telling us that it's a good time to buy stocks.
Yeah.
So that's an unaccustomed role for the president and his top economic advisor, but these are strange times. I guess a lot of people are rather glad now that we didn't privatize Social Security a few years ago because the stock market is at the center of all those schemes.
Well, let's remember that. Just 2005, there was a very serious attempt by the President of the United States to scale back Social Security and divert the contributions we now put in Social Security, all of us workers, about 95% of workers in the United States are in Social Security. It's probably one of the only programs that define us as a nation, you know, that we rich and poor middle class are in the same insurance scheme. He wanted to scale back that program and divert some of our contributions, our taxes, into private accounts. And the promise was we would all invest in mainly stocks, but a balance, you know, with some other things too to balance it out. And we would be better off over time if we had our private accounts. That idea came from the Cato Institute, which is a right-wing think tank and research organization in Washington, D.C., that started in 1972 to be exact, with a little bit of money from Wall Street firms, with a little bit of money from politically right organizations, to actually just start the idea that government should not be as large and that people could manage their own money. And they started that institute when the stock market was flat on its back. In the 1970s, it was almost a negative return in the stock market for about 10 years. I'm sorry to say that to your listeners, but it could be 10 years before the stock market looks sort of consistently positive.
I don't think they regained the 1929 high until like 1954.
That's right.
So
that's right.
That may be ahead of us as well.
That's right. So the idea for privatizing Social Security started a lot sooner than the 2005 privatization effort. And if it wasn't for...
And the guy who leads the effort at Cato was involved in the Chilean scheme.
That's right. Jose Piñera.
Yeah.
Was General Pinochet's labor secretary. And one of the bold initiatives of that dictatorship, remember, democracy was suspended, was to help the Chilean people align their interest with the stock market and capitalists and away from the interest of actually workers. He said that speech to introduce the Chilean people to their new pension system. They didn't vote on it. It wasn't debated.
And the army kept its old public system.
And the army kept their public system. The government actually helped people pay for the new contributions into their plan, though the army kept their Social Security system. But it was very much a political move by the regime to align retirees with the capitalists in the stock market and not with the workers. Under our current system, if workers are employed and they're paying into the system, that helps strengthen the system, and retirees, former workers, are allied with a growing full employment economy. If you actually put money in the stock market, then there's a little conflict of interest.
Yeah, well, I think this is an important point to underline, that the Social Security system is one of the few programs we have in this country that's truly universal.
Right, that's right.
And that is good for developing social solidarity, but also develops strong political support for this. Everybody is part of it, and it has extremely high approval ratings. It's a very popular program. But people like Bush and the would-be privatizers hate it for that very reason, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. It was it was clear when the Social Security system was implemented in 1935 that this would be a program that would make big government or of strong federal government popular. And the Republicans argued against that system in the 1930s on that point, that this is socialism, they called it. They pointed to the Bolsheviks in Russia. They had the same complaints, almost word for word, for the Medicare system, which is even more popular program that was implemented 30 years later in 1965. So there's a great deal of ideology surrounding the Social Security system. But practically, as you said, it's very popular because almost everybody is benefited from the Social Security system. If you're a rich hedge fund manager, you actually might have a mother who isn't as rich, and she is getting a secure pension for the rest of their life, because that's what Social Security does. It's also an insurance program. If you're a young family, you know, far away from retirement, but you have one worker in that family, you have a couple of kids, a dependent spouse, you have about $250,000 worth of life insurance and about that much in disability insurance while you're working, because Social Security provides a death benefit, and it also provides disability insurance. So everybody's covered. It's not an investment product. It's an insurance product.
And while we're praising Social Security, we should also underscore the fact that it's actually, contrary to a lot of caricature, quite an efficient program.
It's very efficient. The fees are less than 1%. It's about 0.5% of administrative fees. Why is that? Because every month the employers are responsible for sending in the contributions. Everybody is in it. The Social Security system can follow people around, know where they live. And so when it comes to issuing a check, the person has to initiate, has to go to the Social Security office. Many institutions help them do that, social workers, funeral homes, an employer. The Social Security offices are very well staffed. They're nicely appointed. People know where they are in every community. It's like a post office. They know where they are. You just have to provide a few documents, and then you your entitlement for your benefits for the rest of your life are established. So it's the employers do a lot of the administrative work. It's automated. It's been there for a long time. There are no stockholders to pay. There's no advertising fees. They spend most of their money on information, not on advertising, but on having very well-versed and helpful employees and a very nice website. So it is much more efficient than the other institutions that run our that handle our retirement money. And these institutions, range mostly are now the institutions that are growing, the individual retirement accounts and the 401k accounts.
Well, the mutual funds and life insurance companies have administrative costs many times that 0.5%.
Oh, yeah. It's actually five times as much. And in a system where these firms compete with each other, the fees can even be larger. And most people who actually pay those fees don't even know how high they are. But the average fee will erode a account that you've accumulated your lifetime of work by about 20 to 30%. And much of that money goes into advertising, goes into to salaries, goes into to stock dividends and other kinds of returns to shareholders. So I think it's important to realize that there's this tension between this commercial individual account system and the Social Security system, and it's really the commercial individual account system that's failed Americans right now, so that older Americans now have probably lost forever, for the rest of their lives, relevant, any kind of a target wealth figure for them to maintain their living standards.
Yeah, I mean, if you contrast somebody who was retiring in 2000 as the NASDAQ was peaking with somebody who's retiring today, very, very different fate in the remaining years.
That's right. I mean, at given your assumptions, person retiring in 2000 and cashing out, when we were at the top of the bubble, could have actually replaced what they earned while they were working. Except you have all that leisure time. And that's pretty good. Now that figure is about 50%, on average, and you have to have a couple of assumptions. I have a couple of proposals.
I want to get to those in a moment. I want to first say that I'm speaking with Teresa Ghilarducci, who teaches at the New School and is at the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis there, and author of When I'm 64.
That's right. The Plot Against Pensions.
The Plot Against
the plan
Pensions.
To save them.
I do want to talk about what's happened to the private pension system. The private pension system before we get to your proposals. But two things. First, the virtual disappearance of the defined benefit plan.
Right.
I think most people know what that is, but what is it and where is it gone?
Let's back up a little bit. There is this common image that the retirement system is built on a three-legged stool. One leg of the stool is personal wealth, personal savings. The other stool is employer-based private voluntary system of employer pensions, and the other leg of the stool is Social Security. And that image is really wrong because it implies that all people kind of get sources of income, equal sources of income from each of these legs. And in fact, for most people, the retirement income is a pyramid, where the base is Social Security. The next layer is employer-based pensions, and the layer above that is personal wealth. I like to think of it.
Most people have very little in the way of savings, and only half of all workers are covered by a pension plan.
That's right. Right. That's why those layers are
pretty wobbly stool.
Yeah, yeah. So the wobbly stool, it's not a good image. The pyramid is a much better pyramid. Now, for some, the base is much larger than those middle sections. But the point is that second and top sections are very small. Think of the food pyramid. The personal wealth is really just the whiskey and chocolate that you just don't have very much of in a balanced diet. So if you think of that image, then you can ask the question, why do we have a retirement crisis? Why are all the predictions that we're going to have more of the elderly in poverty? Why has that happened? And why is it predicted that baby boomers, those people born between 1946 and 1962, will probably do worse than their parents and grandparents in terms of replacing their pre-retirement earnings. Why is that? Is it because of the base? Is that the Social Security? Is that failing? No, the answer is it's those second tiers, the employer-based tier and the personal wealth tier, especially with the erosion of housing values. So in that middle tier, there was for half of the workforce, and even though if you have worked at some point in your life, a much larger percentage of them had some coverage under what's called a traditional pension. Defined benefit plan was a pension you got from an employer or a couple of employers. And what it provided was a pension based on your years of service and your earnings. and it provided you a source of income for the rest of your life. Often it was modest, but it was secure, and it lasted until you did, until the end of your life. In 1978, a change in the tax code allowed companies to take, accept contributions, voluntary contributions from employees in a tax-sheltered account. And that section that was changed was Section 401, and what was added was Section K. And it was put in that, in the tax code, mainly for the benefit of executives who wanted an easy place to shelter shelter money from taxes. Most of companies who wanted this kind of a plan realized it would only be their top paid employees that would really even bother to shelter their income, because after all, the top are the ones that have higher income taxes. The IRS said, look, if you're going to provide this for executives, you really have to provide this voluntary account really to everybody. But it was really understood that the rank and file would have their defined benefit plan, and the top executives would have the defined benefit plan and this sort of extra tax-favored account. Over time, with the decline of unions and with the vigorous advertising campaign and lobbying efforts of mutual fund industries, that 401k plan, that model where people voluntarily put in their earnings into an account that would be run by commercial mutual funds and other kinds of commercial money managers, that became what the company called the pension. And the 401k grew in importance, and the defined benefit plan either shrunk or was actually terminated.
And the 401k comes with rather indirect public subsidies, right, in the form of tax deductions?
Yes. In this country, every country has a way of taking care of its old. And it can be and the way they do it, it can be arrayed on a spectrum. Italy, Spain, Germany takes care of its elderly through a strong state system, like a state social security system, where the expenditures are direct. The federal government allocates a certain amount of money based on a particular tax revenue source for pensions. In this country, we're on the other extreme, where we have direct expenditures, to be sure, Medicare and Social Security, but we also have very large and very fast-growing indirect expenditures in the form of tax breaks. And the technical word for those are tax expenditures. The idea is the taxes we don't collect really is a form of federal spending. The problem with that source of spending is that it's not scrutinized every year for whether or not it's efficient, practical, meets our goals of retirement income security in a practical way, or it's fair. And what has happened over the years is that the tax breaks, the indirect tax spending for 401ks, has grown 10 times faster than the tax breaks for any other kind. Any other kind of pension system, and it's because the highest income employees are taking advantage of it. So right now, we spend about $110 billion a year on 401ks, where we spend a little over $400 billion a year on Social Security, and people don't understand that so much money is going to so few.
And that disproportionately goes to people in the upper
bracket. A couple of more numbers. The top 20% of all workers get more than 70% of those tax breaks. The top 10% of workers get 50% of those tax breaks. And these are to people who don't need help from the federal government to save for their own retirement. The top 20%, the top 10% are the only groups in the United States that really can look forward to an adequate and secure retirement for the rest of their lives. The bottom 80%, the bottom 90% are really going to have trouble doing that, and they're getting a very small portion of that $110 billion.
And these things are often justified because they supposedly increase national savings.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
In fact, the national savings rate went to zero, and these people are just shifting things from one account to another, right?
That's right, and that's a modest goal was, well, if we give tax breaks for savings, maybe people will do more savings. Well, if you give a tax breaks for savings, people just shift their savings from their tax account to these tax break accounts, so there's no savings. And I know this is radio, but if we had a picture, you would actually see when the 401k system came in the 1970s, you see the tax breaks for them increasing, and you see the savings rates falling, and they kind of cross, someplace in the 80s. So on the very face of it, it doesn't provide national savings. And if our other goal was to make sure that everybody had a chance to have a safe and secure retirement for the rest of their lives, you would just see that most of that money is going to people who don't need the federal help.
And now, of course, the savings rate is creeping up back up to 5%, but it's not clear whether our economy can live with prudence of that sort.
Right, and that usually happens in a depression or a recession, as you know. But what is very different about this recession from the past recession is that many people's wealth, their permanent wealth, was in the financial markets, and they're also much more in debt than they ever had been before. So we are looking at the past 30 years having our trusted kind of financial advisors, those people at the local bank who told you how much of a mortgage you could accept, or the person in your human resource department who told you that we have insurance set aside, you know, for your pension, those ways of saving, because that's what housing and retirement savings are, were really old-fashioned, and you were told, you know, to use Jared Bernstein, the economist who was at the Economic Policy Institute, is now in Vice President Biden's office, to use his phrase. We morphed from a system where people got the mixture of insurance and good advice to a system where you were on your own. But what you were done, you were on your own in a sea of mutual fund lobbyists and commercial accounts.
An extremely confusing world. We've only got a few minutes left, but a retirement spent living on Social Security checks is not a comfortable one.
Yeah.
So we would be a good idea to say we can augment people's retirement incomes. What's your idea?
Yeah, well, most of the elderly live on only Social Security, or are pretty much close to only Social Security. So, you know, it's a way to keep you in your house. My plan is to replace the 401k system, but not directly, but to provide an alternative to the 401k system. That was a non-commercial account, that it would be run by the Social Security Administration with a partnership with the system like the federal employees' pension system.
And just to emphasize, this is a supplement to it, not a replacement for
it. It would be
Social
a
Security.
Supplement to it. There's no way we have to replace that middle tier of the pyramid not touch that base, because without the base, those supplements and those other tiers of the pyramid won't matter. Yes, it's a supplement to Social Security. It's called a guaranteed retirement account. People would take 5% of their income and put it into a retirement account, and that would be managed by the federal government. You wouldn't have to choose whether you have a small cap fund or an international equities fund. You would not be responsible to have to pick the best mix of assets. The government would do it for you, and we would guarantee a 3% inflation indexed rate of return. That doesn't put the government at risk, because they would pool all this money and invest in a prudent portfolio. But since the federal government will be there longer than any financial firm, it can actually invest for the long term and can balance out the ups and downs in the financial markets. Many people have such a guaranteed account. I'm a college professor. I have a teacher's pension that I put my money. I'm supposed to put my money in, and they guarantee me 4%. Now, people could have a 401k or a commercial account if they want. There's nothing in my plan that would say that they couldn't, but the tax break would be scaled back so that it would really benefit people who put in the average amount of money in the 401k. And they can gamble with that own money, not with their taxpayers' money. But the important thing is to get people to save more for their retirement in a safe place.
And the details of this are laid out in a paper that is on the Economic Policy Institute website, EPI briefing paper, Guaranteed Retirement Accounts. So anybody who wants to follow up on this should go visit the EPI's website. I think it's epinet.org, if I remember correctly.
That's right. That's right. It's also in my book.
Okay. Well, right? Even better, buy your book.
Okay.
Tell us, we're just about out of time, but tell us quickly what the book is.
You can also get it at the library. The When I'm 65, When I'm 64. When I'm 64, it's an old Beatles song. When I'm 64, The Plot Against Pensions and Plan to Save Them by Princeton University Press.
All right. Thank you. And I've been speaking with Teresa Ghilarducci, who is a professor at the New School in New York City, author of When I'm 64 from Princeton University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. And let's go out with this relatively new thing from an Australian band called 80 Current Suppression Ring, which is an electronic device I discovered. I certainly didn't know that before. This is called Sunday's Coming. Till next week. Bye.